Hello, this is Barbara Peters from the Poison Pen, and it's my pleasure to be sitting here with Brad Taylor on publication day for his 13th.
Wow. I know.
Have we been together for the entire 13?
Yes.
Everybody. Fabulous. And in fact, you started your tour at the Poison Pen for quite a few of them, haven't you?
Yeah. When I was doing two books a year, we would come out here summer, winter, each time.
Did that have something to do with you just now doing January?
Yes, because I did it for 4 years. Basically, what happened was when I wrote my first book and it sold, which was, you know, a surprise, I still had to make money, but my kids still needed shoes and things like that, so I had to do a lot of security contracting. I retired from the military, and so I would look at my schedule, and the book was due in December, basically, and I would be doing contracting from July until January. And so I knew I had to get the book in July. So I would get it in. And of course, the publisher did cheetah flips because, wow, he's 6 months early. That's phenomenal. And I would get mad because I write about current events, and the problem with current events is they're current. And I'm like, why aren't you putting the book out? Anything could happen in the world that would change the trajectory of this book. And they, of course, because I was naive to the publishing world, said, you know, you're not the only author we have. You're due in December, so we're going to wait till December. And that happened for three books. I think The Widow's Strike was a final straw with them. They said, okay, smarty pants, we'll do one every 6 months. And so I did do that for about 4 years, and it about broke me.
Well, I always felt guilty, you know, because you would come in January when it would either rain or at least be pleasant. You come from Charleston, where, you know, and then you would come back and get smacked for the heat of the summer, and I felt terrible. Well, anyhow, so today is actually January 8th. And you just mentioned something I was going to ask you about, which is, you know, this story is very up to the minute, having to do with, you know, Syrian intelligence agencies and all the whole Syria thing. I mean, it was like a gift to you from our president that he decided to stir up the whole Syrian thing.
Well, actually,
even more.
This is the first time you have to, and this is a prime example of it. So when I wrote The Insider Threat, ISIS was still kind of a nobody. Nobody had heard of them. I actually fought them in Iraq, and I knew who they were. And so I was on the two-book-a-year cycle, and as soon as I hit the end of one book, my publisher's saying, what's the plot for the next one? We got to get rolling on this right now. And I didn't have anything. So what I knew about ISIS, at that time they were the Islamic State of Iraq. They hadn't gone into Syria yet. So I started writing the book, and then they took over all of Iraq. And they took over all of Syria. It just went haywire. Now everybody knew about ISIS. They were burning people in cages and, you know, beheading everybody. And I thought, holy moly, we're going to go in there and clean them out. And that will ruin my book. I mean, the whole book is based on ISIS. And they're going to wipe these guys out and there's no longer a threat.
And Brad Taylor, it's not all about you.
Right. I suppose on one hand I was thinking, yeah, go get them. On the other hand, I was like, but not until after publication.
Right.
So we didn't, obviously. And so I was talking to people and thinking about what would get us out of Syria for this specific book.
Right.
This is years later. And it would be a catastrophic event that happened that would turn the tide of popular opinion in the United States. And I was wrong, I guess, incorrectly, because then President Trump said, we're out of here. And luckily we're slowing down now, so, you know, publication's here.
Well, my larger question was, when you're writing something, you know, so close to current events, there's always the danger that, A, the events will overtake your book and either propel it or sink it, as the case may be. But also there's a question of how well they age on the shelf. And so I thought this book, you know, because you've introduced this young girl that we'll talk about, who's coincidentally age 13, and this is your 13th book, that regardless of how it goes in Syria, that this story, you know, has a ageless or timeless quality to it, and that will help you. I'm used to dealing with Daniel Silva, who, you know, writes his books like down to the wire, and faces the same problem of, you know, events possibly overtaking or making the book irrelevant. And I mean, that was a gigantic problem at 9/11 when several people lost books completely. So
it was also a problem for several authors when we killed bin Laden, because they had books in the pipeline about doing something against bin Laden, and then whoop, he's dead.
But, you know, that's the nature of this genre, is that you do want to follow current events. So tell us a little bit about your background. What did you bring to writing this kind of military thriller or special ops thriller that makes you special?
Well, I served 22 years in the military, most of that time in special forces. I retired as a lieutenant colonel, a special forces lieutenant colonel. and served in a special mission unit at Fort Bragg, and I've done classified operations everywhere, Iraq, Afghanistan, other places I can't talk about. But it didn't teach me how to write. I learned how to write by being a reader.
What propelled you into deciding in retirement, aside from trying to keep your kids in shoes, that you wanted to write books, which is not necessarily a path to riches?
No, I actually, if I had known how hard it is to get published, I never would have attempted it. But you kind of, when you're in special forces, you're kind of, you know, you believe anything's possible because you have seen a lot of stuff. So that I had always just wanted to write a book. It was just a bucket list thing. It really wasn't. I had no intentions. I was teaching at the Citadel as a break from deployments, as assistant professor of military science, had a lot of time on my hands, and decided I was just going to write a book, and I thought it would sit on the bedside table. And it sold, and then the publisher asked if I could write another one. I came on the list for bird colonel, for full colonel. My daughter was entering high school. My next assignment was unaccompanied to Pakistan for 2 years, so I had a lot of decisions to make, and I decided I'd retire from the military. Get some stability in my life and give writing a try. Looking back on it, that was incredibly risky, but at the time it seemed kind of natural. But I've been very, very blessed, and I'll tell you that.
Well, I do think that your professional background and all your experience, you know, made you more publishable in the sense that, you know, they can almost look at it as nonfiction. It's always helpful when the author brings something like that, you know, to the table. And, you know, just a comment for me, I think your writing has advanced as you have advanced.
Well, thank you.
You know, well, it should, right?
Otherwise. Yeah, definitely.
But so in this particular book, which has gotten terrific reviews, I wanted to ask you, was Amina always going to be the central part of this book, or was she kind of a device for dealing with the biological weapon, and then she kind of took over?
You completely read my mind. That's absolutely what happened. She
was supposed to be a
linkage in the chain. In fact, the book was titled Shadow Strike for the longest time.
Really?
And she was a link in the chain, and I hadn't figured out how I was going to get rid of her, whether she just exited stage left, she disappeared into the Italian countryside, did she get killed? Hadn't even thought about that because I was thinking about the plot points of what Pike's going to have to do to solve this. And I wrote those first scenes with her in Monaco, and I ended up really liking it. And the next thing I know, she took over the entire book.
I sort of thought that might be true because, you know, you need an instigating incident, as we say.
Right.
I always worry I'm going to trip over those two words. But in any case, you know, she and her brother, they're Syrian refugees in Monaco, and they're pickpockets, right? They're being run as a very Dickensian thing.
Right.
And then she gets a hold of a phone.
Right,
and
the wrong phone.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's really, for a plot, all you needed from her.
Right.
And then,
that's where it was going to, well, it was going to end when Pike caught up to the phone.
Right.
But by that time, I loved her too much, and I knew it wasn't going to end. But the hard part of the book was now she's got to propel the plot forward. She can't just be a character hanging on to Pike's belt loop. She's got to have something, which was hard to design because she has to have, she's a 13-year-old refugee. Pike's a counter-terrorist commando, but she's got to have some kind of skill, some capability that he does not possess.
Right.
For the plot to go forward.
Sure.
And so that was a lot of work trying to figure that out.
Did you watch the televised reboot of Jack Ryan?
I did, the first one I've seen.
And, you know, just the role of the children in it was really quite powerful.
Yeah.
There were a lot of actually really stupid things, like leaving the kid sitting on the stairway with his phone as the police thundered up the stairs. And I thought, hello. Dana Stavridou, I was watching it with me. She came right off her chair. I was like, but I thought that the children really humanized that story and the good and the bad children, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I wondered, you know, Amina's actually somebody you could conceivably keep in the background or keep around.
Right.
I mean, you can't put her out in the field every time.
Right, of course not. But that's actually, I give 110% to every individual book. And when you write the book, it is a series and you're boxing yourself in. You're creating a universe. So when you first start writing and you have a new character, as soon as you say she has blonde hair and blue eyes, that's it forever.
Right.
She's got blue eyes forever.
Sure.
And I've written things about the task force. I base it on, you know, my own experiences, what we would or not be able to do, the capabilities we have, strictures that would be in place, that kind of stuff. And I created a element that now, five books later, I'd be like, well, I really wish I didn't say they had to do X because I need to do Y now. So how am I going to do that? Well, I've created Amina. So, I mean, the next book, I can't just say, you know, she's gone, see you later. I've got to figure out what am I going to do with her in the universe, because the reader's going to want to know. He's going to read the next book, or she's going to read the next book and say, you know, I could start off, I suppose, at a funeral.
Well, or you could put her into school and have them check in. Sure. There's a lot of different things you can do. I did want to ask you also about red mercury, because, I mean, is it even feasible that we could develop a biological weapon, a disease that would wipe everyone out and then magically heal itself away?
Now, red mercury, there's two things about red mercury. Red mercury is an actual real myth. It's absolutely real, but it's a myth. The terrorists have been trying to find it forever. They have this mythological belief that it's like the ultimate doomsday weapon, and it's causing a lot of problems. Say in Africa, there's every 6 months there's a new rumor where you can find red mercury. Right now the hot rumor is you can find an unexploded ordnance, and so kids are getting blown up because they're trying to take apart a bomb because they think there's red mercury in it. But there's no such thing. It doesn't exist. And the North Koreans call their product red mercury precisely because they know the terrorists, it'll be catnip to them. They will hear that and say, yeah, we'll buy it. And so they're kind of tricking the terrorists into the nerve agent they have. Now, the specific nerve agent they have, which degrades over time, we don't have anything like that. There's nothing like that on the shelf as it is, but it certainly could be. They're trying to develop it. And nerve agent in and of itself, the one of the greatest things that destroys nerve agent is sunlight, believe it or not. You spread nerve agent out on the street out there, especially someplace like here in Phoenix, and it would degrade very rapidly just by the sunlight.
Or in the Middle Eastern desert.
Right.
Well, I brought it up because, you know, there was such a controversy about mustard gas and the horrible things it did in the First World War, and I thought that there was a convention, you know, that everybody agreed to outlaw biological weapons.
Biological is a big one. We don't have any biological weapons. We certainly have chemical weapons, and so does North Korea. They've got 5 tons. In fact, the book came about. The entire germ of the idea was we were rattling sabers against Kim Jong-un's nuclear program, you know, fire and fury, and he's testing his ballistic missiles and all this, and we're going crazy. Well, I was assigned the 1st Special Forces Group in Okinawa. Our wartime mission was the Korean Peninsula, so I had a healthy appreciation for his offensive capability. And he's got 5 tons of chemical and biological weapons, enough to turn the entire peninsula of South Korea into a smoke and slag heap. And I always thought to myself, why do we care so much about, which we should care about the nuclear component, but we don't ever say anything about this other stuff. He killed his half-brother in Malaysia 2 years ago using nerve agent.
Right.
And so I thought, wouldn't it be ironic if he sold this WMD to get around the sanctions we're placing on him for that WMD? And that was kind of the genesis of the story.
Yeah, it's an interesting story with the Syrian and the North Korean and then the Russian and, you know, all the rest of it. I thought it was a complicated plot, to put it mildly. So what does Master of Special Op Thrillers, that's what they're calling you, what does that actually mean?
I have no idea. Somebody else. I guess because I have a special operations background. So, I mean, I could tactics, techniques, and procedures. You know, it's kind of like if I was going to write a book about riding a bike, I think about what it's like to ride a bike.
So do you see, you know, is this sort of in the Tom Clancy, Mark Greaney tradition? It's different than, let's say, James Rollins.
Yes.
Brad Thor has a different spin on it.
Yeah, I'm definitely middle of the road as far as politics. I'm still a voracious reader, and I don't like it when someone's trying to feed me their politics in a book, either pro or con what I believe in. And so I try to stay away from all that and deal just straight with national security affairs, how this would affect the United States. Regardless of you know, political.
Okay.
I mean, this is the 13th book, and I've never even said what party the administration belongs to.
A wise move. No, I mean, it's just interesting because it seems like it's a broad umbrella, and then there are very distinct personalities within it. You know, Gabriel Alon is his thing.
I would hope to be more Gabriel Alon. Put it that way.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's Scott Horvath over here, and then in the Clancy universe, I really like Mike Madden. I really liked his books. He started out with the drone thing, and I think he's done a really interesting job with Clancy. But then Mark Cameron has a different, and he's writing about Jack Ryan Sr.
I'm certainly not as big as the Tom Clancy universe because he's got 18 different spider webs going out there.
I know, but I guess what's interesting is, you know, for people who like it, you know, what do they see in each of you that makes it possible to read over the course of a year a fairly concentrated number of books under that umbrella, but yet they're different enough so it's not like having a hamburger every night.
Right. You'd have to ask my in-laws. They read all those books, and he's got Greeny, every one of them, he's read them all. So.
Well, Phoenix has always been a big market. We have a big, you know, Air Force base here and all the rest of it. And Vince Flynn, of course, was enormously popular here. I still miss him. He was, you know, he came to the store put the books in the trunk of his car. Remember, he self-published his first book, and I still remember him walking into the back room of the store and saying, "Hi, you know, I have this book." which we didn't do with you.
Which little we know where that would go. So.
We didn't, but it was wonderful. Well, listen, thank you for your time, and I'm looking forward to book 14 already.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You bet.